Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and our total health environment. Our food, water, air, and earth, our communities, our attitudes, our media, our social policies, and the state of the environment on planet Earth. Every week on this show, we talk to different experts, authors, advocates, activists, scientists, and others about different facets of the ways we need to see the interconnection that always exists between ourselves, each other, and our whole environment. Today's show is going to feature a guest that I've actually had on several times before with a new participant, and I'm so excited to have them on the show. They have an upcoming event that's really excited that will be exciting that we'll be talking about more that you can participate in. So my guests today are Bill Cousins of the organization Less Cancer, as well as Suzanne Tobias, who's going to be participating in the Less Cancer Challenge 300, and you'll be learning about it more on today's show. It's coming up really soon. So let me first bring on Bill Cousins to tell us a little bit about Less Cancer and what your mission overall is, what your story is, and what your mission is. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Bill Cousins.
Hey, Allison, how are you doing? Thanks for having me on today.
Great. Lovely to have you here. So just tell our listeners a bit about what it means to have the goal of Less Cancer.
Well, Less Cancer is a campaign of Next Generation Choices Foundation. We were founded 10 years ago, and we were founded actually after my sister died of pancreatic cancer because I was moved and concerned about what seemed to be increasing incidences of cancer, which of course, there are. While I'm not a scientist, I was very concerned about these issues. So when we formed the organization, I understood it was critical to have scientists on board, critical to be guided by evidence-based science, because you know my background is really as a communicator and as a marketer. But I'm passionate about the cause. We, as you may know, we're founders of National Cancer Prevention Day. I spoke on Capitol Hill, actually with Susie, who will be on the show, this last February 4th. And that resolution was sponsored by Congressman Israel from New York.
And what is it that you're, what kinds of initiatives would you like to see going forward to actualize the dream of less cancer?
Well, you know, cancer is a giant blanket of terms and stories and situations, and there is no one, magic bullet for any of this. But we do know that 2/3 of cancer are preventable, and often we'll say, we'll hear from people and even in my own case with family, if I knew cancer was preventable, don't you think I would have done it? Well, mm-hmm. It is. Doctors and scientists tell us they can't necessarily tell us who's getting cancer, but they know that 2/3 of this comes from outside of their body. And if that's the case, there are lots of things that we can be doing. And we know that in the case of obesity, for instance, and we know that in the case of asbestos, an environmental exposure that has been closely linked to cancer, or smoking. So, there's been a lot of conversation lately about tanning oils, for instance, and sunscreens, mm-hmm. and some of the problems with those, which, of course, there are. But for me personally, I'm a little bit more concerned that we have something like 30 million users of tanning beds in this country and increasing, I don't know what the numbers are off the top of my head, incidences of cases of terminal melanoma in young folks. So, we really do have a big situation on our hands, and for everybody to see a difference in the reduction of cancer incidence, we're going to have to get on board with policy, communities. We're all going to have to be on board. And, while each person's individual choice or decision in how they live their life is critical to their personal health, it's awfully critical to reducing risk for cancer. So there's many things that we can do through, you know, the way we live, through the foods we choose to eat, through, you know, there are plenty of roads to go down on that front. So, you know, but part of it, it isn't just that alone. Part of it's policy. Part of it, you know, educating lawmakers, educating schools, educating communities. And that's what we do. I think you know, Allison, in the social network, we have about 100,000 followers, which has been really instrumental for people sharing ideas and concepts, and also sharing the latest science that may be out there that, you know, of course, is evidence-based.
So, you know, but so far the emphasis in our society, I mean, there are two ways that people define the term prevention. When it's used in conventional medicine, prevention will mean, for example, a mammogram will be conceived of as prevention. What you're talking about is, you know, nutritional changes, regulating toxic chemicals, you know, avoiding tanning beds, you know, a combination of social policy and individual things, not just only screening
to determine where you are. Screening is actually early diagnostic. It isn't necessarily prevention. So we're really talking about stopping it at the cause. Now, I know in the case our chairman is a gastroenterologist. I know in the case of, you know, colonoscopies, they can often, through the removal of polyps, you know, remove or reduce or lower that risk for cancer that way. But in the case of a mammogram, you know, that is typically, you know, early diagnostic. So that is what we're really talking about, is preventing it altogether. We have crazy increases in some blood and brain cancers under, you know, in children under 14, for instance. Things that I don't really understand, but I want to include in the conversation. I want to ask lawmakers and scientists and physicians why we have more and not less. Why do we operate under this break and fix policy that we currently are working under? And, you know, it's very, very difficult to get funding for anything to do with prevention. It isn't a financial model that we in this country really understand. So, you know, but it isn't, there's no one answer. There's no one, you know, magic piece of wisdom. But, you know, this is a conversation that we've had going since Richard Nixon introduced this in the early 70s. And we have seemingly been treating more and more cancer. We have whole economies based on cancer treatment. And we're not hearing about less cancer. We're not really hearing about cancer prevention. We know that there's such a minuscule amount being spent on these issues.
So it's kind of become normalized that we just kind of accept that we have cancer and, you know, it's increasing. So are the treatments, so are the treatment costs. And there's kind of, you know, a sort of almost a sense or an assumption, an uninformed assumption perhaps, that whatever exists today is what has always been. Do you have any sense of the historical context for this? I mean, is the
we have been marketed to cancer for many has become almost an expected stage of life, hard to imagine. You know, I often hear, well, anything causes cancer, everything causes cancer, you're going to get cancer from something. It doesn't need to be that way. It wasn't that way. It never used to be that way. And, you know, now we have babies being born with cancer. I don't understand that. And so these are questions that we're asking. Allison, I have had people in my life and my family, people I've loved and have been super close to, that have died from cancer. I wish there was that cure. I wish there was that magic bullet to save those people, to save my mother, to save my sister, to save my brother. I wish there had been those tools in place to save those people I love. And you know what? I'm not underestimating or minimalizing the treatment. I really think that we just need to focus more on not getting to that place. Less altogether. So it's not like I'm, you know, dissing what's out there. God mm-hmm. knows I have hoped and prayed like millions of others in this country for a cure. Hoped mm-hmm. and prayed just this one time that person I loved would make it through this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there is a lot of focus on that right now, which is why we believe, you know, really 10 years ago, we were really the first in this whole idea or notion of left. Mm-hmm. And the term left and cancer was never used together. It was always beat, conquer. And then before you knew it, we were turning cancer patients into athletes. And, mm-hmm. you know, we had run for the cure and raised for this. And, you know, there were lots of accolades and ribbons and medals and celebrity. And it was something that didn't really resonate with me, that, you know, we were finding these giant corporate contributors to these races who were also at some level contributing to the health of America and marketing to, you know, these people. I'm concerned about the fact we have, you know, a whole generation of people that have done nothing but eat bad food. And, mm-hmm. you know, what does that mean for our future?
So what you're saying, too, is that it's kind of when people say to you, well, everything causes cancer, it's kind of like what that says is there are a couple of things. One, we're in an environment that's causing cancer, and there's, you know, sort of there's an acknowledgement there. Well, we're in an, but it's at the same time it's kind of normalized because it's kind of frightening. We're in an environment that causes cancer. There are so many things in the environment that could be contributing. We can't avoid or do anything about them, and then almost the sense that we don't want to know about it.
I think if I can just step on for one mm-hmm. second. Just one quickly, I think what happens is things take on the landscape of our lives in our homes, on TV, on the radio, and because we're so effectively marketed to. And as a marketing guy, I've been part of that problem. I understand that. And so there are lots of things that take on the landscape of our lives where we don't really understand the outcome. We don't mm-hmm. really get it. And, you know, there's that old but true story about Kent cigarettes where, you know, at one time they had the American Medical Association, AMA, sponsoring, you know, having Kent cigarettes sponsor their meetings and were advertising with them. And they had models up there showing how Kent cigarettes, because of their filter tip, were the smoothest cigarette, the healthiest cigarette, the best choice for a cigarette. That, of course, was in the 50s when they discovered that filter tip actually had asbestos in it and that there were, you know, clearly larger outcomes for that situation. I think they discovered that in around 1955, continued mm-hmm. to produce that same cigarette butt until about 1959. And, you know, we assume because it's legal, safe, and advertised that things are good to go. Well, we know smoking has been a major, major problem as far as cancer and people dying from cancer. Mm-hmm. So, but there was a time where people were, you know, they were good with it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, the overall figures now, as far as we know them, are that there are more cases, but there are also more people living longer, but that's also due to more treatment, more expensive treatment, some people not able to access treatment, and that whole kind of ball of wax. So in a sense,
and what does longer look like, Allison? I mean, that's my thing. Is longer mm-hmm. 7 more days in a bed screaming? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these people are an incredible, you know, many of them have, you know, have really suffered and are suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And so while it may be longer, what does longer look like?
Mm-hmm.
I'm concerned that, and it's a discussion that I get all the time, I get into this because I hear from lots of different families and people that, you know, really cancer as far as prevention and end of life is really marginalized on the in the world of finance. I hear from hospice people that the average stay of a hospice patient is about 7 days. So there's some hospice people that believe it could be, you know, 300 days. Mm-hmm. That, you know, only at the last minute when there's nothing more that they can do they show up at hospice.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that, say, that treatment necessarily hasn't increased their longevity.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe, you know, we're not really looking at hospice. But then with the pressure to keep people in, to keep patients in hospital beds, it's mm-hmm. tough for them to turn these patients loose to hospice.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they're under, it's a real catch-22. They need to fill beds in hospitals. They want to fill beds in hospitals. They're under pressure to fill beds in hospitals. So what does that mean? And, you know, what does that mean for that cancer patient that should probably be in hospice? It means they're in the hospital getting treatment.
Oh, and dear, I see what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Do you see what I mean? So
yes.
It just is. It is, you know, it's a real catch-22.
Mm-hmm.
Really complicated. And none of these people, you know, the intention isn't to have more people suffer, but mm-hmm. because there's such a profit model associated with this,
mm-hmm.
it's really, you know, a problem.
Mm-hmm. And who is making the decisions in most cases? Is it the person themselves? Is it family members? I mean, you know.
Well, I think that they're told a story. They're given a certain set of circumstances, and, you know, they're selling hope. I've been at that other end. I understand what that looks mm-hmm. like. They are looking at somebody like myself who wants to hear this is going to be okay. I want to hear they're going to win this war. I want to hear they're going to be just fine. And they're in the business of peddling hope. But, you know, I may have mentioned, you know, last time we talked, I'm not sure, I was in one cancer institute where there's a Wendy's restaurant right in the lobby.
And
I just can't imagine how that upholds human health or what they were thinking. So, you know, it just is. There are lots of places and lots of pieces that we need to really look at, rethink, and understand how we're going to go forward.
Mm-hmm. That totally makes sense. I mean, and that's really, you know, it's really, this is the toughest job, which is being proactive in the face of, you know, one of the most varied, dreadful, and rising health concerns, you know, namely cancer. I'd love to hear a little bit more about the people who join your organization. Are
mm-hmm.
they survivors? Are they family members? I mean, 100,000 is pretty impressive.
It's mm-hmm. interesting. You know, we've had a lot of people from, like, Malaysia, Indonesia, Bangladesh on
really?
One of our Facebook pages. I didn't really understand it, but when you look at the incidence of cancer in those areas associated with industry and some other public health issues, you know, we are getting, you know, people are reaching out to us from 33 countries. And, you know, it isn't just a thumbs up or a like on a page. It isn't just a share. It's really people getting engaged in the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And of this idea of prevention, reducing risk. And, you know, it is, I think more and more people are interested in it. 10 years ago, Allison, I think you knew me 10 years ago, there was nobody talking about this. You, maybe, as a journalist, the only one in the world, maybe. But very few people understood the idea of less. It just wasn't part of the conversation.
Is that happening more, do you think, now?
Well, I think people are getting the idea that there are things that they can be doing differently. They're understanding that sometimes food that looks very healthy, in fact, is very toxic.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I talk to people, I'm always saying, you know, I'm a little bit of a junk food guy. I love cupcakes. I'm an ex-smoker. Sometimes I fall prey to Twizzlers, you know, but I know it's junk food. I know it's bad food, and I know it's got to be done, you know, very carefully. But, you know, I've had to make that transformation as well, and I'm not, you know, it's not like I seek to do my own gardening or, you know, eat a million types of greens a day. But I do, you know, I throw everything in the blender. I buy tons of greens and vegetables and fruits and throw it all in. I drink it up every day. I try to move every day. I try to make smarter, healthier choices to reduce the risk of cancer in my own life. So, you know, but it's not easy. It's not perfect. And I think that there are a lot of, you know, health gurus out there that are quite superior, quite, you know, intimidating when they communicate these messages, and that people don't really understand that they have a chance of turning things around. And it also, you know, it is, it's also, you know, it has to do with the size and weight issue. And, you know, there are lots of larger people that are quite healthy. So, you know, health doesn't necessarily look like anorexia. And, you know, so it is, we are so marketed to as a society that we have these preconceived ideas because of a soundbite or because of something we saw for 26 seconds. So, you know, it's funny because people will ask me about grocery shopping, and I'll go in the grocery store, and, you know, I'm just like everybody else. I've got a million things on my plate. I've got a lot of things to do, and I'm looking for solutions. I instantly am the guy that gets pulled into buy this. This is healthier and cheaper. I'm instantly the guy that is easily marketed to. But, you know, I know that in my head I have to stay to the outside of the store. I have to buy Whole Foods. I stay away from anything that isn't assembled, you know, and anything that I have to read. I'm not a great reader, and there are lots of words I don't understand on these packages. Anything that gets into that, I don't even buy. So, you know, I try to keep it as simple as possible. And I always look for a USDA organic label unless I know the farmer myself on these issues. I'm lucky because I live in a rural area, and I know a lot of farmers, and I frequent our farmers' market. So those are things that are changes that I've made, and they're changes that other people can make to eat smarter and reduce risk. And, you know, by the way, Austin, when we work to reduce risk for cancer, lots of things are addressed, like diabetes, asthma. You know, lots and lots of things are addressed when the high bar is preventing cancer.
What about, what's your positioning? I have to ask this, of course, because I think since you were last on the show, we've learned of Angelina Jolie's decision concerning getting a double mastectomy due to having two of the BRCA genes, I don't know how to pronounce it exactly, but the genes that are more, that make people more prone to breast and ovarian cancer. You know, and so obviously that's very deadly and difficult when people have those genes. I mean, but perhaps, I mean, I would never counsel anybody. I don't have the information to counsel anyone in making that decision. I'm sure you wouldn't either. But, you know, what are your views on, you know, radical solutions of that kind or, you know?
I'm a little bit conflicted. I mean, I'm honestly, I don't know. I'm not a scientist or a physician at all. And, you know, I'd say that continuously. But I know that that surgery is very painful, and I hate to see her or anyone experience that kind of loss. If it saves her life, you know, I guess great. But, yeah, you know, I'm sorry that we've had to come to that place with the environment and our you know, we've got, while she may carry that gene, I just wish that it could be handled in a less aggressive way. But I don't know if that, maybe it's the only way. I don't know. You know, I just don't have that information. And, you know, my heart breaks for all people that have to go through those kinds of efforts to beat cancer. Does it mean it's wrong? No, none of it. I just don't, you know, I just don't know. And
The whole genetic component is also, you know, kind of the next front of the hope for cure.
Right.
Is occurring, you know, on the genetic front, the idea.
But do you understand anything about, like, epigenetics and how genes can change? Or, you know, I don't have a great handle on that myself either.
I do.
But we do.
Yeah.
But we do have an epigenetic, you know, a geneticist that does understand those issues. And it's interesting how environment can change genes. So if, in fact, we had a healthier environment, would genes necessarily look that way? You know, those are right. questions that I have as a C student from Wayne State University, really. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. it's like if we can change a gene and reshape genes through the environment and our choices that we make in life, and we can actually pass that on to our offspring, do we still need to be working on the environment? We still need to be working on some of these issues that are actually having transforming effects for the next generation.
Right. I mean, I think that just to give a little brief on epigenetics, basically when they studied all the genome, they were expecting that they would find, you know, hundreds of thousands of different genes in the human genome because of our complexity. But in fact, when it came down to it, there were only about 22,000, which is akin to what a field mouse has. So it then became apparent that there was not just the genes themselves, but the epigenome, which really governs how genes are turned on and off. So, you know, the basic principle there is that genes are either silent, they're not activated, or they are activated. And the whole dance of which ones are activated and by what, or deactivated and by what, is what we're talking about here. So the idea is that, you know, if you're exposed to a toxin, and this has been one of the recent, so there's some new research concerning, for example, the BT toxin in GMOs, which mm-hmm. I have covered extensively on the show, and the fact that that could be acting on, you know, turning on a whole bunch of viral genes. This is very recent new research that really raises that concern and provides one mechanism of negative action from this being spread throughout the food supply. So, you know, and the point is that if you eat healthy greens, for example, this will turn down, you know, mutagenic, cancer-causing genes, and will turn up other kinds of genes. So, you know, the whole thing is that everything, we're in a dance. It's not just like you took a pill and then you're done. Our organism is
in it. Beautifully said. And we are in this dance, but it is, mm-hmm. it's ironic to me. It's just crazy that we, through eating habits or through the way we live and the choices we make, can mm-hmm. actually make a shift in our genes for the next generation.
Mm-hmm. So, both for ourselves and for the next generation.
Yeah, that's what I mean. And so it is, so then, you know, it actually always comes back to the environment. It always comes back to those kinds of lifestyle choices. But you still want to be able to address this issue. And so you ask about, you know, the surgery, you ask about some of these other things. I just don't know. I mean, I think, you know, it's certainly a conversation that we need to continue to have. Is it right? Is it wrong? Should they be doing this? You know, there's no way I could second guess that or counsel anybody ever on that. Mm-hmm. And but I'm worried about it. You know, I'm concerned about her and anybody that has to go through that operation.
You know, we're going to take a break soon for station identification, and,
okay.
you know, I would like to then bring on our next guest, but before we take the break, let me just ask you quickly to kind of set up the second part of the show. One of the things that you do, as well as educate, lobby, serve as a resource for people to get involved, you know, exchange and dialogue with your many members, brainstorm and come up with creative solutions about prevention. One of the things that you also do is you have activities and events. So after the break, I'd like to hear more about that, as well as bring on Suzanne Tobias to talk about one of your upcoming events, which I think is so incredibly exciting. So we'll be taking a break now on Connect the Dots. Please stay with us for the second half of the show, talking with Bill Cousins and Suzanne Tobias about Less Cancer and the Less Cancer upcoming 300 race. Stay with us here. I'm Allison Rose Levy for the second half of the show. We'll be right back. Welcome back, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and today we're talking about less cancer and the Less Cancer Challenge 300 we'll be discussing in this half of the show. If you missed the first half of the show, you can find us in the Connect the Dots archives on Progressive Radio. And please make sure to like us on iTunes, as well as forward this wonderful program to your friends, colleagues, and anyone who you know, has experience or interest in the important topic. We're discussing Less Cancer with Less Cancer founder Bill Cousins, and we've been discussing that all throughout the first half of the show, and now we're going to bring in Suzanne Tobias, who is going to be participating in the Less Cancer Challenge 300. So, Bill, just tell us a little bit about the challenge, and then I want to find out about Suzanne and her participation.
Okay, that's great. Can you hear me okay, Allison?
Perfectly.
Great. The Less Cancer Challenge is really something that came about because Susie had wanted to do this ride in honor of her good friend, Eileen O'Brien Grace, and she had wanted to do it in Michigan during the Port Huron Mackinac sailboat race. So I thought, wow, that's great. What are we going to do? How's this going to come about? And we came up with this idea, because it's 300 miles, to do the Less Cancer Challenge 300. So while we're not in the business of bike riding, or long distance bike riding at that even, people could do 300 of whatever they wanted wherever they were. So if you wanted,
that's my kind of race.
Yeah, mine too. So like, why make it crazy? So if Allison wants to do 300 jumping jacks in the month of July, she can go on CrowdRise to the crowdrise.com/challenge300 and create her own team and get friends to get on board to support Allison's 300 jumping jacks in July. Or it could be 300 miles. You could do 300 miles in, you know, Texas, where Susie is, and support her that way. You could join her team, Girls on Fire, which she's done with our friend Martha Fruoff, and or you can combine those miles. So it's really 300 of anything, and you can get a group to accomplish that, or you can do it by yourself. Susie's chosen to do it by herself. Susie's been incredibly devoted to the Less Cancer cause, and we as an organization would be sunk if we didn't have her devotion and volunteerism. And so she's been quite good. She's been very supportive. National Cancer Prevention Day, where actually she did speak about her friend Eileen. And Eileen was, by the way, my friend as well. She's mm-hmm. the younger sister of our board member, Miles O'Brien, who you may remember from CNN, who's done so much work on PBS Discovery recently. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, she's great. Her energy is great. And I'm very excited about this event coming up. I think it's going to be really, really great.
When is it happening?
Well, it starts July 20th is when Susie's taking off at some god-awful hour in the morning. And she'll be riding right to Mackinac Island, Michigan, straight through. So,
from Texas?
No, not from Texas. From Port Huron, Michigan to Mackinac Island, Michigan.
Okay.
300 miles. She will be coming, though, from Texas to do that ride.
Mm-hmm. Susie, tell us a little bit about, you know, are you training for this now? Or, you know, what's... are you in shape for that? That's quite a ride.
Well, it is quite a ride. And Allison, hello. Thank you so much for having me on.
So delighted to have you here.
It is quite a ride. It's the furthest ride I will ever have attempted. But I'm riding my bike pretty much every day and trying to psych myself up, really. But
how long do you think it's going to take you to do?
Well, I would like to do it in somewhere around, ideally, I would say somewhere around 20 hours, two 10-hour days. But we're kind of building a little bit of time into that. So if, you know, we have mechanicals, you know, it really depends on the weather. It could be torrential rain.
you know, which slows down your pace. Or, you know, we could have some mechanicals, you know, you have to stop, fix flat tires, or, you know, if we have something more serious, you know, chain brakes or something like that, you know, it takes a little bit of time. And then, of course, you know, there might be, you know, times when we have to just get off the bike for a little bit and just kind of rest. But ideally, I'd love to do it in 2 days, but we've allowed ourselves, you know, a half of a third day. So
That's terrific. And so is there a team that's going along with you, Team Girls on Fire? Are some of them going to be traveling with you, or they're your support team?
It's, you know, there will be riders riding along with us. We have, I grew up in Michigan, in Southeast Michigan. You know, that's where my friend Eileen and I, we rode our bikes all over that area and, as kids. And, it was something that we both, you know, an activity that we both loved. I will have, there will be a few people from that area who will be joining us on the ride. For some or all of it, but there will be people along, and then Bill will be in a support vehicle, you know, either behind us or ahead of us, you know, paving the way for us to come through towns and things like that. So, so we should have a pretty good little posse riding up the state of Michigan, and we're really excited about it. And we've gotten a few followers as well, you know, just people who have had family members who've suffered from cancer and things like that who have come on and said, you know, when you're riding through, you know, Pinconning, Michigan, are you going through our town? We'd love to be there to cheer you on. So we've actually developed, you know, grown a bit of a following in that way.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's terrific. So,
yeah.
You know, tell us a little bit. I mean, tell us a little bit about, you know, your friend and, you know, what really spoke to you in terms of what she went through to do this, to undertake this.
Well, you know, Eileen was my very best friend in the world. And you know, when you lose somebody who's that close to you, she was like a sister to me. Mm-hmm. To lose somebody, you know, is very difficult. To lose her in the way we lost her was extremely difficult for me. I had never really, you know, I'm a rare case where, you know, I had not lost somebody that close to cancer ever in my life. I had never witnessed it. And I witnessed it with Eileen.
Mm-hmm. And how old was she?
She was 47.
Mm-hmm.
And she was, you know, she had been really strong through the entire experience. I just can't even believe how much fortitude she had and what a fighter she was. And the days that she must have gone through, you know, I can't even imagine, because it was just really devastating to witness. And but she was strong. She was always upbeat. She has two beautiful daughters that, you know, she was, you know, always, you know, always with, would do anything for. And you know, it was just really, really difficult to go through that. And I remember she had come to Austin to visit me, and she was feeling really great. And this was probably April, and she was feeling good, and she had gotten some good news from her oncologist, and, you know, so she was excited, and she wanted to get a bike, and we had ridden our bikes all of our lives as kids, and she came in, and she wanted to get a bike. She wanted me to take her to the, you know, shop to go pick one out, and so we bought a bike, and we were all excited, and we made all sorts of plans to ride in, you know, events, and she wanted to get back in shape. She had been, you know, working through this whole thing for a couple of years. And she was really finally at a place where she just really wanted to get in shape and move forward. And this was April. And we got her bike. And by June, she had made a turn for the worse. And things were really progressing very badly. And she went back into radiation, And I remember I was really upset, and I was, you know, feeling sorry for myself, which is just outrageous. You know, I was angry, you know, angry, and I felt bad for her because she had been so excited about, you know, moving forward. And I would wake up in the morning and I'd say, oh, I don't want to ride my bike today. But then I think, well, gosh, Eileen's going to radiation. Well, why don't I just ride my bike for Eileen? Because she would love to be on her bike today.
Mm.
And so I'd say, okay, well, if I'm not going to do strong enough to do the miles for myself, I'm surely going to be strong enough to do the miles for her. And so I would go out and ride. And I would just say, I'm doing this for her. I'm not doing this for me. And that sort of became the theme. And as things progressed, and we eventually lost Eileen, I think that it sort of took over, that whole idea took over in the grieving process. And, you know, in those mornings when I didn't want to wake up in the morning, I would say, no, I have to, because Eileen would love to be on her bike right now. And so I would head out on my bike and put in those miles and think about her. And it really was something that was hard and difficult. But every time I go out, even to this day, you know, she's there with me, and I feel like she's, you know, she's right there on my shoulder. And so when I started, you know, when I got together with Bill, and I've been doing some things for Less Cancer, and we were working on this Move Detroit event that was in Detroit back in early December. And, you know, it's this whole idea of getting people active, getting people moving, thinking about obesity as you know, in the connections that it has, and the connection between obesity and cancer and physical activity and prevention. You know, we were in Detroit, and we thought, you know, there's this great sailboat race, the Port Huron to Mackinac. Eileen's great-grandfather was actually on a boat that won that race, and Eileen and I, you know, were all over northern Michigan and southern Michigan on our bikes in the summer, and we thought, gosh, wouldn't it be cool to, you know, what a challenge that would be to ride our bikes to Mackinac and see if we could get there as fast as these sailboats. And you know, we loved the idea. We loved the connections. And, you know, Eileen really is the person who introduced Bill and I. So she brought us together. And there were all sorts of these little tiny connections that came together. And we decided that this was the event we were going to do. And I thought, you know, 300 miles is a long way, but we can do this. We can do these miles for Eileen. And that's how it all kind of started.
Oh, that's fantastic. I really love that, because there are so many different things that are unified there. The sense of you know, moving through loss and moving together with the person that you care about so much, and at the same time moving for health. I mean, you kind of have it all in you know, kind of all together in this one event. I mean, it's just, and with the location and everything, I mean, that's just going to be a very moving and powerful occurrence. And basically also you're saying that any of our listeners can participate wherever they are.
We encourage that. We really want this ride to really bring this awareness that we can take part in this. You know, the war on cancer does not have to, you know, be left in laboratories with researchers. We all take part in this thing that is cancer, and it starts, we can play a role in prevention. We can you know, through what we eat and our activities and just this understanding that we can play a part in trying to reduce incidences of cancer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it does. There are so many facets of it. And we encourage people everywhere to, you know, there is a direct connection between obesity and cancer. And, you know, research has proven time and time again that physical activity, you know, is a good form, you know, can help prevent certain types of cancer. Physical, you know, activity that, you know, helps us to maintain a healthy BMI and such. So we want people to know that there are things that we can do to help reduce our risk.
Mm-hmm,
so.
Mm-hmm. And if people want to participate, they can go to the lesscancer.org website and look for Less Cancer Challenge 300, and it kind of shares the story. It gives different ideas of what you can do if you want to, do as Bill described, 300 jumping jacks,
yeah,
or walk 300 miles, breaking it down over, just 10 minutes a day,
yeah,
for, a certain number of days. And people can also donate to the activities of Less Cancer, all by going to the Less Cancer Challenge. And this is coming up. It's basically for the whole month of July. Is that right?
The challenge itself. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. No, you can tell us too. Sure, go ahead.
The challenge itself goes, for everybody who wants to take part in the challenge. The challenge is from July 1st, the month of July, and you, mm-hmm, can do 300 anything. Mm-hmm. And what's great about that is, I'm passionate about cycling. But somebody else might be passionate about kayaking or running or spinning on a spinning bike or tennis. And so they can come up with 300 minutes, 300 meters, any form of 300 will work. And you can do your own activity and you're still supporting, this great cause. So
if I can interject just for one sec. They can also combine their 300. So
exactly,
if Bill wants to do 25 and Susie wants to do 75 and Allison wants to pick up the rest as a team, we can combine. Hmm. So, we just really want to get people out and moving the month of July.
Hmm. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Gosh. And I've spoken to another person here who, she wants to participate at work. She said that she's going to walk 300 steps. She's going to use the stairwell at work instead of the elevator. And she can, do 300 flights of stairs over the month of July. And she's like, I can do that. I won't even know I'm doing it, but I'm doing it. And, she's very excited about it.
Oh, that's really cool. So everyone can even, kind of count the stairs if you have stairs in your home,
yep,
or you climb stairs to an apartment. I mean, there's just so many different ways to participate. You could do 10 minutes of yoga every day. I mean,
exactly.
Whatever. Yeah, whatever. Oh, that's really terrific. That's such a great thing. And also, I think previously we've had on the program Lynn McTaggart, the author of the book The Field and The Bond, and I've blogged about her, and she's another one of our recurring guests and just a terrific person who works with intention. And, what this is combining is both movement and intention, a positive intention that's both, dedicated to the person that you care about or whom you've lost or, someone that is meaningful to you, but it's also dedicated to the larger field and the larger picture, because as Bill Cousins was telling us in the first part of the show, when, you're in an environment where, people kind of say, well, everything causes cancer. When you're in an environment where a lot of people are getting cancer, you're in a larger field that's kind of where this is being created, and there are many people to whom you're connected, that are going through this, whom you may, know or not know so well, and all of that. And we feel so helpless. I had a work colleague who became ill, and it's just, we lost him, and it's just you just feel helpless. You just don't know what to do. It's a terrible loss, and this is a way of kind of, the whole idea of Less Cancer is taking these losses and kind of turning it in a direction where, if we move toward prevention, toward the things that Bill Cousins was talking about. Bill, maybe you want to come back and just, wrap up with us a little bit here toward the end of the show. But, if we make steps in those directions, those directions through education, through policy change, through lobbying, through events like these, then, ideally fewer people have to suffer, go through this, or, you know, die from it in this horrible way. So,
I think you're exactly right. And, you know, you have been a pioneering journalist in this arena as well. And your influence and impact has been great on lots of communities as well. You know, when we talk about lobbying for a second, I'm not a lobbyist. I'm just a guy that knocks on doors and works to educate lawmakers or anybody, you know, that's out there. And I think the one thing that we've been effective at is getting people on board with making different choices in their lives and for their communities and thinking twice about some of their choices. Mm-hmm. We have provided an opportunity to introduce prevention into the cancer conversation and have asked people to look more closely at these situations is driven by the evidence-based science. You know, I mean, you asked me about Angelina and some of these other issues. That's not my thing. Mm-hmm. But I know that there are people out there with a lot of wisdom and knowledge on that area that can speak to it. I was driven. I got here just like Susie because of loss. Mm-hmm. Not because of my knowledge in cancer or as an expert. And what we've been able to put together is a space where people can communicate these issues and, work to get it a step closer. You know, Less Cancer works really in two channels. We work on the ground in communities, and we also work online. That's the part we've talked about. We talked about the fact that we are connected through the web, through social networks, through, you know, our blogging, through some of those pieces. But we synergize that through some of our programs, partnerships, and collaborations on the ground. We did, you know, Move Detroit wasn't just about getting out and moving. It was about creating a Less Cancer Prevention Education and Research Fund at the Children's Hospital Michigan Foundation. And the money that was used for that, a big piece of that money went towards educating whole families on addressing the obesity issue. Mm-hmm. And in a place like Detroit where there are, you know, food deserts and there are some, although, by the way, they just opened a Whole Foods there, so that's exciting. There are plenty, there were less choices about where to get food in that city. And so, you know, the programming that we've been involved with is really getting people on board with, you know, picking healthy foods, getting out and moving, doing some of those things. But, you know, it's interesting from my perspective, you know, we say get out and move. We think no-brainer, throw the kids out the front door. But in a place like Detroit where, crime's an issue, there's also an issue with a lot of stray dogs. So they've had to really think about things that we wouldn't normally think about, which I find very interesting. And so that was one idea. That was one program we did. We recently partnered with the University of Virginia School of Nursing on another one. And so that's really kind of how we're working. But it only happens not really through us, but through other participants, such as these institutions or yourself, or lawmakers, or so, you know, it's great because we've been able to facilitate this change in communities.
And so listeners who are interested in participating can also go to the lesscancer.org website where they can, and they can join your page on Facebook. They can follow your blogs, your links about different issues, and as well as these collaborations and other events that you're engaged with. People can also get involved and get engaged. You know, I just want to comment, which is, I'm sure I've never said this on the air, and I don't know if I've ever told you this, Bill, in any of our conversations, but, you know, when you say that the awareness of cancer and of a loved one going through this health concern is something that motivates people to action, it's actually the core reason I think I got involved in reporting on health to begin with, because of my dad and his going through cancer when I was a teenager. And so I'm absolutely certain that I know for sure that going through that process at his bedside and in the hospital setting and all the rest of it, and he did, you know, survive and live on for many years, thankfully, was really what woke me up to the need for proactive health care, you know, and doing the best we can for our health. So, you know, and given the numbers of people for whom this is a case, I guess what I would urge, and we're kind of coming down to the end of our show very rapidly here, but is, you know, take the wake-up call. Take, you know, because cancer is sadly a wake-up call. And so take it not both to mourn and to grieve and to, you know, kind of be there for your loved one and all the rest of it, you know, or to sustain them through a journey to health, whatever is the path that it takes for you, but also take it to join with like-minded people and to make a difference and to help you know, these various ways of preventing or making ourselves stronger and healthier and more resilient, as well as moving public policies toward the regulation of chemicals and other things that increase cancer incidence. And we do, as Bill says, we need more science, too, and that's another important leg. And by all means, you know, join the dialogue, get less cancer. We're kind of winding down to the last minute or so of our show. I just want to thank you so much once again, Bill Cousins of Less Cancer and Susie Tobias of the incredible challenge that you're doing. And I want to thank you listeners for being with us. Come back next week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time. We're here every Wednesday with Connect the Dots on the Progressive Radio Network. And I am Allison Rose Levy. Thank you for being with us again this week.